Hi, everybody. Today is Thursday, June 5th, 2025, and our friend Alex Craner is back with us. Well, welcome back, Alex.
Thank you for having me, Nima. Good to be with you again. Greetings to everyone.
Just before starting this talk, sorry for being late. We had some sort of technical problems here. Alex, let's get started with what has happened between Russia and Ukraine. And we had a drone attack on Russian nuclear bombers that were in the open. Here is what General Blaine Holt, who is politically close to Donald Trump, said about what has happened in Russia.
Concerned about global or national security in my life than I am right now. And yes, I understand it's a tactical win. The Ukrainians have a tactical win. But they hit a third of a strategic bomber force that is covered by a START treaty that goes back to 2010. There is no Russian in the military there that believes that Ukraine was able to achieve this without Western intelligence help, including our country. Mm. General Konnikayev, the leader of rocket forces for Russia, has now openly said they are now locking in the coordinates for Paris, London, and Washington, D.C. This is an escalation path now without a reverse gear. I pray there's a reverse gear that President Trump can find by calling President Putin. But as a military officer with 27 years of service at the flag level and NATO service, I can tell you we are in a big dangerous place that we weren't in 3 days ago. And I pray that something good happens in those talks today.
We know what has happened in the talk between the two presidents. Your take on that, Alex?
Okay, so we have to go back in time a little bit. I think that this was an attempt probably led by the British political establishment or foreign policy establishment, to be more specific, to derail the peace talks. If we go back to the beginning of the war in Ukraine in February of 2022, the Foreign Office of the United Kingdom established something called Project Alchemy. Project Alchemy was maybe still is a group of veteran UK military and intelligence veterans who put together a strategic document titled something like Ukraine Next Chapter, exploring the strategic options for the futures, something to that effect. And they very clearly lay out in that document that the priority, that the most important thing for the British establishment, is to keep Ukraine fighting, so not to allow them to sue for peace, not to make sure that whatever happens, that the war carries on, because so long as it does, and they spell this out as well, that the British intelligence will be able to stage various destabilization operations against Russia, and that the longer the war drags on, the more the Russians will end up being disqualified in the eyes of the global public, and that ultimately this will lead to Vladimir Putin's ouster, to a regime change, and this is what they want. And if we go back in time even further, you know, we go back to 1945 when this same foreign policy establishment plus the British intelligence services drafted the Project Unthinkable. And Project Unthinkable was, you know, recall, this is while World War II is still full on. This is before the war ended. And the British were already preparing their next stratagem to attack Russia. And so in the document, which was drafted for Winston Churchill and presented to him in at some point, I think April 1945, they say, "Oh, hey, okay, we have basically two options. One would be a very quick, powerful surprise attack on the Russians. And to do that, we would need to bring together the Americans and take advantage of whatever is left of German manpower and industrial capacity, plus Polish manpower." And so that would be one way. But at that time, FDR was still alive. So the Americans said, that's madness. Never mind. This is not happening. The second option was a total war against Russia at some future date. And they said that this getting to this total war would take a very, very long time. They didn't specify how much time, but you know, you could infer from the document that they're thinking in years or decades. And so, you know, this all speaks to the undying obsession of the British Empire, which is still, you know, in some zombified state there. It's still alive and kicking. It's still stirring the pot everywhere around the world. And they, I think, they got the Ukrainians into launching this attack in order to make sure that the peace talks in Istanbul fail. I think that so far as Trump is concerned, I think that he and the Russians and everybody else understands that there are rogue elements in the CIA and he doesn't have control over them. And there's also a lot of psyops going on through the media. For example, one of the things that was reported by CNN in the immediate aftermath of these attacks on Sunday, that Pete Hegseth was watching the attacks going on in the real time, which would imply that he was in on it, which would imply that, you know, well, he's appointed by Donald Trump, which might further imply that Donald Trump said, yeah, get it done. I don't want to know anything about it. But that, you know, he had a hand in it, that he knew this was going to happen and that he's basically trying to undermine Russia and that his outreach to Russia is insincere and that it's some kind of a devious manipulation. I think that's a psyop as well, because the globalist powers led by the British are desperate to make sure that the rapport between Russia and the United States doesn't take hold, that the relationship is derailed, and that the United States finds itself drawn back into the fold of the European powers, and that it recommits to Project Ukraine. So I think this is what's going on, and I do believe that the Russians are smart enough to see through all of this, and they know that if they reacted, because another thing about the attacks that we have to point out is, if they wanted to just harm Russia in whatever way, they had many other ways to do it. You know, they didn't have to go for the nuclear strategic bombers. They could have gone for power stations. They could have gone for water facilities. They could have gone for any number of things, refineries, oil refineries, any number of things that would have caused more harm to Russia than this did. The reason why they did this is because it crosses the line of Russia's nuclear doctrine. So it gives Russia legal justification, at least so far as the Russian laws are concerned. It gives them legal justification to retaliate not only against Ukraine, but against any country that has facilitated the planning and execution of this attack, which would then mean that if if the Russians responded by launching missiles against France or Britain or Poland or, you know, somewhere like that, that would give the West pretext to invoke Article 5 of the NATO treaty, and then they would get their all-out war against Russia. Exactly the total war that the Operation Unthinkable was proposing as something that would have to be orchestrated in order for Britain to achieve their political objectives. And they defined their political objectives as imposing our will upon Russia. That's coming from London. That's not Washington. That's not NATO. That's coming straight out of London, you know, foreign policy, intelligence circles. And so I think that Vladimir Putin is smart enough to know that falling into the provocation, responding in the way that they hoped that he would respond, could trigger World War III, which would for them be the most precious Christmas gift that Putin could possibly give them. And he knows not to give them that gift. And I think that Russians understand that the best possible revenge they could exact is by taking Ukraine all the way to Dnieper, including Odessa, closing out the Black Sea, and probably taking Kiev as well. We'll see, but you know, this is my take on the situation.
Alex, here is what Stormer said in somehow amazing that they're helping, as you've mentioned, Ukraine to attack Russia, and they're coming out that we are under attack from Russia, we are under pressure from Russia, we have to be prepared. Here is what he said.
And today, following through on this review, I want to set out three fundamental changes that we're going to deliver. First, we are moving to warfighting readiness as the central purpose of our armed forces. When we are being directly threatened by states with advanced military forces, the most effective way to deter them is to be ready.
Yeah. Who's threatening the United Kingdom? I don't know if anybody in Russia is threatening the United Kingdom or attacking United Kingdom, but he's making the rhetoric. Just if there is a single person on this planet who wants the war in Ukraine more than Zelensky, that we know that he's going to lose his position, as Putin pointed out, is Starmer, with this sort of rhetoric on his part. Go ahead.
Well, yes, it is Starmer, Nima, but Starmer is just a puppet there. You know, he's not in charge. He's the front man for the people who are really in power. The policy was no different under Tory governments. You know, we had Rishi Sunak, we had Liz Truss, we had Boris Johnson, we had Theresa May, we had David Cameron. The policy never changes. And, you know, thanks to Liz Truss, we have now some evidence of what I've suspected for a long time, and that is that she went recently last year, on Steve Bannon's War Room, and she said something very important there in a statement. She said, well, when I got to number 10, I thought as a prime minister, I would be in charge. I would be able to implement the policies that I think are appropriate. And what I found out when I got there is that I didn't have the levers of power, that the Bank of England holds the levers of power. So, you know, again, we always have these indications that the real source of power in Britain is the banking establishment, and that all these wars are not happening because they want freedom and democracy for the Ukrainians or for the Cameroonians or for the Nigerians or anybody, the Bosnians, Macedonians, you know, wherever they're starting to, you know, burrow into the system of governments there. It's because they are there to install or prop up friendly governments that will allow British banks to finance the development by issuing credit to their clients, which are, you know, multinational corporations like Rio Tinto and Shell Oil and BP and you know, BAE Systems, the arms manufacturers. And then, you know, the resource, natural resource wealth of those countries by virtue of governments controlled by Britain, it becomes the wealth of the British financial system. And given that the British financial system is in an absolutely dismal shape, they are now desperate and they will risk World War III, a total annihilation, in order to preserve this enormous privilege that they have by means of this, you know, very fraudulent and pathogenic financial system under which we all operate, by the way. But, you know, it comes from Bank of England. They didn't invent it. You know, it comes from Venice, Amsterdam, Bank of England, and so on. But they are kind of the, you know, the strategic and philosophical, so to speak, headquarters of this whole juggernaut that defines the conduct of the Western powers and you know, the track record of the Western civilization, which has been, you know, 500 years of total war on humanity, pretty much.
Alex, these oligarchs in the United Kingdom that you're talking about, how powerful are they? Are they even more powerful than the king in the United Kingdom? They can manipulate the policy of the king. We know that Starmer, in his visit to the United States, he asked Donald Trump to come to the United Kingdom. He wanted the king to send a letter to Donald Trump. In that term, he wanted to somehow manipulate the foreign policy of the United States in Ukraine. But how powerful are these people in the United Kingdom, and what is the relationship between the government, the king, and these people?
Well, they're definitely more powerful than the king. They, you know, the king serves at their pleasure. And that is, you know, for centuries now, people who have been close to power, you know, I can't come up with names now, but I think maybe people like Benjamin Disraeli and others have given statements to say there's something behind the throne that is more powerful even than the king. And, you know, we know that they can and do take kings out and install new kings as it suits them. And today we know for certain, it's not a conspiracy theory, that they had King George put to sleep in the run-up to World War II, because, you know, they wanted a certain change of policy. I'm not sure exactly what and how. And so they had a doctor who was King's personal physician inject him with a mixture of, I think, morphine and cocaine and something else. The king knew, by the way, that they were putting him down. And he was furious, but he was completely captivated by them, and there was nothing he could do. And they also controlled the media. So before the king was put down, they ran many stories about King's ill health, that he was very frail, very bad health. And so when they finally injected him with a, you know, with the lethal injection, then they were like, oh, you know, the king succumbed to his illness at last. He was so weak and frail, blah, blah, blah. But now we know for sure that he was put down because the doctor who killed him wrote in his diaries that he did it. And the nurse who was there present, she also knew. And so, you know, who can possibly be so powerful to basically shut the king away from the public, create the narrative the king is very ill and in very frail health, and then give him a lethal injection and then install a new king? There's no reason for us to think that King Charles today is in a better position than they are. And then I would question also how Queen Elizabeth died. It's very odd, very strange, but it also kind of coincides with their, with the new colonialism that is emanating from London, because, you know, this is all happening very silently. But the British again are sending their, you know, their military trainers to places like Cameroon, Uganda, Tanzania, Kenya, Nigeria, and they are, you know, sending their diplomatic people to discuss cooperation on development of, you know, natural resources extraction and all of this. So basically, it's a different packaging on the same thing, which is a revamping of colonialism. And so I don't know, this started, as far as I can trace it back, it started either around 2014, maybe a little bit earlier, I don't know. And so maybe Queen Elizabeth wasn't exactly the person to have there. And then she suddenly died. And I don't know how she died or where she died. I just don't know. I just know that it's very strange, the circumstances in which she simply vanished from the scenes. We have that last photograph of her shaking hands with Liz Truss. And then the very next day she was dead. But that photograph looks very strange because normally we have some video coverage. You know, the new prime minister comes to meet the queen and have that, you know, first meeting and introduction. There was just one photograph. And the photograph was very strange because the queen, as she's shaking Liz Truss's hand, is looking at her belly button. She's not looking her in the eyes. So, you know, it doesn't fit the ordinary course of events. And now we have King Charles. And King Charles reads his script. He doesn't decide policy. They tell him what he's gonna what he's gonna say and do, and so he's all on Davos agenda, climate change, and all these net zero policies. Who knows what he really thinks? But ultimately, it doesn't matter, because if he took a different tack, he wouldn't be there anymore. They would figure out a way to get rid of him and replace him with somebody else.
Alex, if we accept the role of the United Kingdom in what has happened in Russia, do you see Donald Trump trying to manage the situation with the United Kingdom? Because as this general mentioned, the situation is far more critical, far more important than what was told on the mainstream media. And they're trying to exaggerate the power that Ukrainian had to attack the Russians. But despite this sort of exaggeration, we have to consider the importance of this attack on nuclear bombers. This is something, as you've mentioned, this is not something, a teeny tiny thing that you can ignore. You have to deal with it. What would, in your opinion, Donald Trump yesterday talked with Putin, what would be the proper action, the proper reaction maybe on the part of Donald Trump if he didn't know, as he mentioned in this phone call, he didn't know about it?
I think that Donald Trump did exactly what was appropriate. He called Vladimir Putin directly. And I assume that he wanted to make sure that Putin understands that this is not, that he didn't plan this. He didn't do it. Maybe they mentioned that there are rogue elements in his government. Russians understand this. But, you know, for the Russians, the relationship with the United States is extremely important. So they will give Trump all kinds of leeway and all kinds of, they will cut him all kinds of slack to make sure that the faction that is leaning away from the global empire and towards multipolar integrations, that faction is alive and well and that it has political legitimacy. So the Russians will never come out and say like, ha, you see, Trump is, you know, he deceived us, he betrayed us. They will keep this alive for as long as possible. And I think that Trump, he took a day or two because he probably needed to ascertain the facts so as not to embarrass himself to, you know, call Putin immediately and they then end up saying something that turns out not to be true. They had a long conversation, 1 hour, 15 minutes. And I think that I'm getting stronger and stronger impression that the fault lines are being more and more clearly defined, that this is a struggle between the globalist, the reincarnation of the British Empire, which has penetrated the structures of power in the United States very extensively, because they've been doing it since before World War II. And the sovereigntist powers that want to reverse this course and return the United States to its Republican tradition. And that tradition, you know, the United States came to be exactly as a reaction to this imperial abuse. It's exactly the rejection of the empire. And, you know, I do believe that Trump is sincere in wanting to effect this change. And, you know, people say like, you give Trump too much credit, you're too optimistic and all this. But, you know, guess who agrees with me? The Russians agree with me. And guess who else agrees with me? The British press and their leaders. Because if you read the British press, they hate Donald Trump. They hate him every day. Every day, the British run articles disqualifying Donald Trump, demonizing Donald Trump, his government. It's always something to undermine him and weaken his position. So they're clearly very concerned about what Trump is doing and direction in which he's leading the United States. And so I think that, you know, the military officer, I forget his name that you showed, he's absolutely right. This is an extremely dangerous moment in history as it unfolds. But I think that the Trump administration needs public support for what they're trying to achieve. And they have been very vocal about what they're trying to achieve. You know, they said, you know, post-World War II order is obsolete. It's being used as a weapon against us. We don't want to support and fund and pay for the defense of the Europeans and their security policies. We don't want to run the empire with all these hundreds of military bases around the world. Below the surface, there's talk about scrapping CENTCOM and AFRICOM, but simply dismantling that whole thing. You know, Trump has been wanting to withdraw troops from Afghanistan, Syria, Iraq, and Europe, even during his first mandate and during his first presidency between 2016 and 2020. And every indication is there that he's still on that same policy side. It's just that he's facing very, very stiff opposition from people who are co-opted into this globalist system, like Lindsey Graham, like who knows how many people in the CIA, National Security Agencies, FBI, the Treasury Department, and so on and so forth. So we have to understand that this is not going to be a smooth sailing for Trump, and that the media, which are largely British controlled, even in the United States, are going to do absolutely everything to make Trump look as bad as they possibly can. But, you know, the fact that he called Vladimir Putin and that they had a positive conversation in the aftermath of these attacks should tell you everything you need to know about where he stands versus where the British and the Europeans stand.
Yeah, I think the problem on the part of Donald Trump is that he doesn't have that sort of patience to deal with the briefings, all of that. We know that Vladimir Putin is somehow totally different when you look at him and the way that he knows everything, each and every corners of the foreign policy of Russia. But Donald Trump is not that much, I would say, even not interested in going to that direction, because Colonel Wilkerson mentioned the other day when I talked with him, he said that he's not even receiving briefings. J.D. Vance is receiving the briefings. Then he briefs to Donald Trump. This process can make a lot of problems for Donald Trump. If we assume this administration is somehow different from the Trump 1.0, and we have Tulsi Gabbard in the government. We know what is her position. And she doesn't want any of this, not in my opinion, not with Ukraine, not in the Middle East. But how do you think that still they can manipulate even Tulsi Gabbard, J.D. Vance, Donald Trump all together?
Well, they can sabotage them through their underlings that are not loyal, you know. They can do that for sure. And, you know, you're right that Trump is not handling this very well. He spends too much time on the golf courses. The fact that he's not getting briefed every day is very worrisome. But okay, J.D. Vance is better than nothing. Tulsi Gabbard, still, you know, I don't know what to think, but the British thinks that she's a Russian agent, you know, so that's, you know, from where I stand, that's a good sign. And I think that this globalist cabal can do a lot to derail Trump's policy and to damage him and to damage his political standing. But Trump does have allies, and he has, I think, very powerful allies as well. Because as I'm learning, and I can't give you any concrete outlines of this, but it's not just that Trump is opposed to the policies of the global empire, where the United States was the chief military and political and diplomatic and financial muscle. It turns out that the policies of the empire, in the Middle East, in Ukraine, in Eastern, in Europe in general, are very incompatible with the United States. They are causing a lot more harm than they're giving than good. They're depleting the United States. And the opposition to this is not just Donald Trump or a few people who are, you know, sentimentally attached to the idea of 1776 and the Republic and the Declaration of Independence and all these nice things. It seems that the opposition is far more robust and far more extensive throughout the, you know, different nodes of the United States policy establishment, and that this opposition is kind of gathering momentum. So Trump is not alone in this. It would be much, much better if he was more thoughtful about things he says, his posts on Truth Social and on X. It doesn't serve him well to shoot off the, you know, off the hip and you know, every few days say something really unforgivably stupid. But I think that at the core, he's leading the United States, or he means to lead the United States in the right direction. His intent is to end the U.S. role as the global policeman for the empire. And so I think that should be welcomed and supported by everyone, not just in the United States, but everywhere in the world. And that if he's successful to any extent, that's an improvement or on where the Biden administration and Kamala Harris would have led, which I think, you know, if you need the ideas about what this would look like, just look at Keir Starmer's UK. That's I think that's the direction in which the United States was being dragged.
Alex, the way that you're talking about the British government, the oligarchs, bankers in the United Kingdom, it reminds me of the character Popeye. And because they, it seems that they see the character is the United Kingdom, and they see Ukraine as spinach and the United States as their arms, as his arms. And they want to use Ukraine and the United States to fight Russia. And I don't know if both of them are important. Spinach and arms are so important for the United Kingdom to fight Russia. Do you think that in the Russian government, the policymakers in Russia are aware of? Because whatever happens in Ukraine, they have to consider the long role of the British government in Ukraine. They're not gonna get out of Ukraine. They're gonna be there. They're gonna manipulate the situation. They're gonna make the situation even worse with the far right, these nationalists in Ukraine. The obvious evidence of that is this attack on the nuclear bombers. This shows how radical and how dangerous these people can get.
The answer to your question is yes. I think that the Russians are perfectly aware of all this, probably more so than most of us. And I just this morning I came across a post. I forget where exactly, but it was like a little video recording of a KGB and the new Russian KGB. I forget and NSA. I forget.
It's
not NKVD. It's not KGB. It's It doesn't matter. Russian equivalent of the CIA. So he was an analyst, and he gave this 2-3 minute statement in which he lays out almost exactly all of these things that we have been discussing now for several
FSB months. FSB
FSB yeah FSB yes. So he laid out almost exactly all of this that we've been discussing here for months now, because it's, you know, they know this, but it's come to the stage where it's becoming obvious to anybody who's paying attention. You know, how obvious is it that, you know, you have this war in Ukraine and everybody thinks it's the United States pushing the war. But then Donald Trump comes into the White House and says, like, okay, we're not interested in Project Ukraine anymore. And then the British just go insane. They get hysterical. And rather than saying, oh, thank God our big ally is done with this so we can go home and, you know, deal with our economic and social problems at home. No, they say, like, no, we're, you know, we have to prepare for war. We have to support Ukraine. Keir Starmer goes to Kiev and signs a 100-year partnership with Ukraine and commits to financing them £3 billion a year for as long as necessary, and arming them. And you know, they want to take control of their ports and their electricity and their media. And they want to. They already took control of their media. They want to now increase tenfold the supply of these drones that they just used in Ukraine against Russia, because, hey, look how fantastic that works. And they're not even hiding it anymore. It's out in the open. And then, of course, you know, the way they do things is always by proxy, because they have no intention of going to war, but they want to mobilize Poland, Germany, you know, Romania, Bulgaria, Hungary, everybody they can, to go and fight this war, because their principle forever has been, let you and him fight. And so, you know, to be able to mobilize their allies, they have to show that they are dead serious about this and that they are ready to lead. And believe me, they will continue to try to get the United States into the fold, even if it takes eliminating Donald Trump, or even if it takes waiting another 4 years, they will continue trying, and they will continue interfering in the US elections to try to make sure that their candidate wins. And so this is, you know, unfortunately, several hundred years of history, always the same. And they've been obsessed with Russia for more than 200 years now, launching invasion after invasion after invasion, or supporting other powers to launch this invasion financially and with troops and with armaments and with everything, you know, Sweden and Poland and France and Germany, now Ukraine, then next. They're going to try somebody else, whether it's going to be Poland, Baltic states, Germany, everybody together, however they can finagle it, but they will never give up. So long as this same cabal is in power in Britain and they retain the same financial system that they have now, they will never give up. They will never stop.
Two forces in Washington right now are putting pressure on Donald Trump. And one part says that we have to put more sanctions on Russia. We know that Lindsey Graham went, we had Mike Pompeo, Lindsey Graham together with Blumenthal, they went to Ukraine. They want 500% secondary sanctions on whoever wants to buy Russian energy. We know Russia, China, we have China, India, and even European countries that are going to be affected by this sort of policy. Do you feel that they can, Donald Trump somehow, yesterday we've learned that Donald Trump is trying to avoid that, just to not that be passed in the Senate in the United States. But how long, how much can they put pressure on Russia? How can they put pressure on India? We know that China would not be in that sort of policy, but how much pressure can they put on India? And is Europe, on the other hand, we know that Europe is going to be affected. Is Europe concerned of that? I'm talking about European countries. I'm not talking about European Union.
Yes, and yes. I think that I'm not even sure that this is for real, because they are pushing it through Congress, but this is so dumb, and so it will prove so counterproductive that I suspect that it's a psyop more than anything else. You know, that it's just a means of exerting pressure on China, India, whoever else to stop supporting Russia, or, you know, to stop trading with Russia. Because if you introduce 500% tariffs on anybody who buys Russian energy, you're going to sanction half the global GDP, almost. And if you do that, you're going to harm yourself probably more than you're going to harm your adversary. And, you know, maybe the price of oil will go to $200 a barrel, and what would that be? You know, $7, $8, $10 per gallon on the gas pumps in the United States. Well, that's not going to make you very popular in among the American people. So I think that the gambit is profoundly idiotic, and I think that it only shows that the globalist establishment are out of ideas, they're desperate, and they're panicking. And so, you know, 500, why not 10,000%? What's with that number exactly? I think these are desperate measures to try to somehow reverse a defeat that is already cemented practically in Ukraine. And you know that they've been throughout this war, many people like Boris Johnson and Tadeusz Morawiecki and a number of these Western officials have been saying We can't lose in Ukraine. If we lose in Ukraine, it's the end of Western hegemony. Well, everybody wants the end of Western hegemony, except the people who have privileges and advantages from Western hegemony. And that's a very, very narrow segment of our societies in the West. And, you know, they also target their own populations. So it all feels very fragile, very desperate, very last gasp of the empire. And I think it's going to fail. Now, if the United States does, if this passes through Congress, I think that Donald Trump will almost certainly veto it. And if he doesn't, maybe that will be another blow against the globalist open market system. But I think it's too radical. I don't see it. I don't see it happening.
Alex, when we talk about the empire is just collapsing with Western hegemony, many people think that we're somehow hate the United States, but it's totally the opposite way. It's totally the opposite way, because this didn't work. This sort of strategy, this sort of mindset didn't help the United States at all. It's just the situation is getting worse. The hegemony is killing the United States. The empire mindset is killing the United States. Could you elaborate a little bit on that? Because many people out there think that we are against the United States. We are against. There's many people in the United States believe that. It's not just about us outside the United States.
Yes. You know, I've been observing that for as long as Donald Trump has come on the political scene in the United States, already the first time he ran for president in 2016, that a lot of the world public was very, very supportive and hopeful of Trump's candidacy. Because I think that people, even if they don't understand small nuances of how, you know, the system works, they do perceive him to be a break with the, you know, with the continuity of the system that is somehow always bringing us into these constant, never-ending wars, constant, never-ending crises, economic, social, you know, everything falling apart, infrastructure of society falling apart, education, healthcare, everything. And so people want an end to this. They want an end to wars. They want an end to the decay. And I think that they correctly identified that Trump was the leader who was going to lead the United States in a different direction. And so, you know, when he won in 2016, there was, you know, a good chunk of the public in the West. I live in Monaco, you know, south of France. So I'm more, you know, I see the reactions in Europe, in Southern Europe. And I think that a good chunk of the population was very happy that he won. But it was a bit split. By 4 years later, the 2020 elections, the support for Trump was very strong, very, very strong. And the disappointment when he lost was profound. And then, you know, now again, you know, I think that a good chunk of the people are supportive of Trump, but I think that there's, you know, first of all, the mainstream media, and this also spills over into social, into the social networks, the mainstream media are extremely hostile to Trump, and they demonize them in every way that in which they can. And then Trump himself, you know, he's changed his approach. He's doing these, you know, he tosses a stun grenade in one direction, then he does something in the other direction. So it's very difficult to read him. The support I feel is there, but it's much more cautious now. You know, people are not sure, is he for real? Is he going to be able to prevail, or is the swamp going to destroy him again? Are they going to be able to defeat him, or to sabotage his policy so that the result is something opposite of what is intended. I think that with time, the situation is going to be becoming clearer and clearer. And I think that the support for Trump is going to rise again, or is going to become much more pronounced. The people are going to not hesitate to express their support for Trump. I think that's what's going to happen. And, you know, from what I observe, you know, as many flaws as he has, and as many mistakes that he makes, and some of them are profoundly stupid and embarrassing, when it comes to the big moves, to the big things, he does the right thing. You know, he's, for the time being, he has avoided going to war against Iran, and he has negotiated with them. He has secretly held negotiations with Hamas. He's speaking with the Russians. He's speaking with the Chinese. When, you know, in February of this year, when the British sponsored a UN resolution that was going to declare Russia as the aggressor in Ukraine, the United States voted against that resolution. You know, United States took the side of Russia and Belarus and Iran and North Korea. So that's, you know, we cannot, these are very important developments. So we can't take, and importantly, he withdrew United States as a security guarantor for Ukraine. That is absolutely huge. And so we have to, you know, we have to keep in mind that in all the blizzard of information, disinformation, psyops, we have to keep our eyes on the really, really important policy moves. And to my mind, the really important policy moves so far, I think, give an encouraging picture of where Trump is taking the United States.
Alex, two conflicts in the Middle East and in Ukraine, any of them that can be solved would help Donald Trump and his position, and maybe the MAGA, the movement in the United States that helped him to win the election, presidential election, and save it for J.D. Vance if he would be the next president of the United States. This is so important, in my opinion, for the movement that gave some sort of support to Donald Trump. But do you, out of these two conflicts, which one is closer in your opinion? Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin talk about the conflict, the negotiations between the United States and Iran in this phone call yesterday. Even Putin said he would be willing to be part of the negotiations, to participate, to facilitate the process of negotiation, which I would assume it's a extremely positive sign for the United States, both for the United States and Iran. And do you think that maybe if they can get something with the case of Iran, that would facilitate the conflict in Ukraine? Because Russia shows how important Russia is for solving not only the problems in Europe, but also in other parts of the world, maybe in Asia, maybe with the case of Taiwan. Russia, in my opinion, is one of the most important factors and vectors, whatever you can call it. There's a superpower, but beyond that, they have a very crucial role in what's going on in the world. I don't know if Donald Trump really appreciates that sort of role for Russia.
I think that Donald Trump does appreciate that role. I think that Donald Trump's principal mistake is that he overestimates his own influence. Or at least he wants to, you know, he wants to come across as, I'm the boss. I'm, you know, the alpha male in this mix. And so he's everywhere he goes, every relationship in the world, he comes in as though, hey, you know, you're going to do as I say, and we're going to get along, and we're going to sign a deal that I put in front of you. And then, you know, you're going to be doing so well because we're going to invest here and, you know, all these things. And, you know, maybe, you know, some decades ago when the United States was half of the world's GDP, maybe that was the case. But today people think like, yeah, right. Okay. But still, nevertheless, you know, the United States plays an extremely important role in the world today. So it's, you know, as Sergei Karaganov said at the beginning of Trump's mandate a couple of months ago, or maybe even before, he said that, and Sergei Karaganov was maybe is still a very important advisor to Vladimir Putin. And so he said that the way we see our role is we need to help the United States transition from being the global superpower, the hegemon of the world, into being a normal major power in a way that's as undisruptive, as the least disruptive as possible. And so I think that cutting a deal with Iran would be an important diplomatic win for Donald Trump, and it would gain him, you know, it would gain him very important political points to be able to have an upper hand over all the crazies and fanatics in the U.S. government who want war with Iran. You know, we know who we're talking about, the Jewish Zionists, the Christian Zionists, and you know, that these people are very, very fanatical, and they their ideas about what needs to be done are not based on rational assessment of the situation. They are driven by this messianic agenda that, you know, they don't care if the world ends. They still want that war. And in this sense, I think for sure the Russians can help a lot, because the Russians have cultivated a very good positive relationship, not only with Iran, but also with Saudi Arabia. So I think that Trump and his government will have a lot of help from the Middle Eastern powers, but obviously not from Israel. And you can already see that there's a deepening rift between the Trump administration and the Netanyahu government. But Netanyahu government is the process of deposing Netanyahu has already begun in Israel. Whether it'll be successful or not, we'll find out. But, you know, the political momentum to take him down is already there. It's already happening.
Alex, to wrap up this session, one of the crucial points in the talks between Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin was this sort of confirmation on the part of Vladimir Putin that he's going to respond to what Ukraine did. And we had General Jack Keane on Fox News talking about it's time to, because they see somehow the way that Ukraine attacked Russia, somehow Ukraine is much powerful. They can do a lot of damage to Russia. Let's arm them. We don't know if that would work. After we are approaching 4 years of the conflict, he doesn't know if sending more arms to Ukraine would help the position have some sort of leverage on Russia. That's quite amazing. But how, in your opinion, what would be the response on the part of Russia? In my opinion, they're talking about the battlefield. They're not talking about something big and explosive. If they wanted to do it, they did it by now, but they could have done it by now. But how does Russia see if we put ourselves in the shoes of Russians right now, what would be the best response to what Ukraine did?
I think the best response is to prevail on the battlefield and then to push to the Dnieper River and to take control of Odessa and all of the Black Sea coast of Ukraine. Because as we learned from the, you know, British 100-year partnership with Ukraine, the British wanted to take control of Ukraine's ports. And, you know, one of the benefits of controlling the ports is you can keep on smuggling in arms, chemical, biological agents, troops, terrorists, whatever you want. And that would be, you know, perpetually used to orchestrate sabotage and terrorist attacks on Russia. Who knows, maybe biological and chemical attacks. And, you know, the British have a long tradition in doing exactly these kinds of things. You know, they, you know, one of their main policy tools in conducting foreign policy has been opium wars for more than 200 years. So, you know, today in Russia, you have, I don't know how many million exactly, but I think it's more than 3 million Ukrainians who emigrated from Ukraine to Russia. And so, you know, they're, you know, it's not easy to distinguish them from ordinary Russians. And, you know, you could, I'm sure that among those people, you can find enough of them who would be happy to earn some money by smuggling drugs into Russia, you know, all these fentanyl and all these synthetic concoctions that are highly addictive and highly destructive. And so, you need to close off their access to the ports. So that's why you need to take control of Odessa one way or another. So I think that would be, from Russian point of view, that would be by far the most powerful way to respond and to then completely disable, not completely disable, but to severely disable British attempts to destabilize Russia through terrorism, sabotage, chemical, biological agents, and so forth. And then, you know, I heard somebody talk, I don't know whether that makes sense or not, that Russians might blow up all the bridges across the Dnieper. But, you know, that's
the British strategy.
Yeah, exactly. That would be the British strategy. I'm not sure whether that makes sense, you know, it's one of those things that might seem to make sense in the short term, but in the long term, it might actually do more harm than good. So, but you know, taking Kiev, that I think is a distinct possibility as well.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Alex, for being with us today.
Great pleasure as always, Nima. Greetings to all, and until the next time.
See you soon. Bye bye. Take care. Bye.